Rise. Court is now in session. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court welcomes the Delaware Teaching Institute, who are our guests today, and sponsored by the Delaware Legal Related Education Center and the University of Delaware. Counsel, ready?
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
It is a privilege for me to be here today. May it please the Court. This is the case of Ismail v. State. It is on appeal. It involves sentencing provisions which were enacted on June 30th of 2003, which were remedial in nature, and their applicability to one in defendant's situation, that is, one who has not been tried, convicted, or sentenced as of the enactment of those remedial provisions. The statutes involved in this case are 16 Delaware Code 4763, the separate enhancing sentencing statute related to second or prior convictions of possession with intent to deliver. Another statute involved is 16-47-53A, the trafficking in cocaine statute, particularly the sentence reduction contained therein. And the other statute involved is 16-47-51, possession with intent to deliver cocaine. As was mentioned earlier, the amendment was enacted. The amendments were enacted on June 30th, 2003. Trial did not occur until August 27th. A judge's verdict was rendered on August 28th, and sentencing occurred on December 23rd. We argue in this case that the June 30th amendments are ameliorative in nature and that those sentences should apply to defendant Ismail's case. There is no legal bar to doing so. It would be consistent with the General Assembly's intent in enacting the June 30th revisions.
Well, Ms. Dunn, you say that, but how do you respond to the last clause of Section 211B, that is the language that reads, unless the amended act expressly provides to the contrary, for purposes of such proceedings, the prior law shall remain in effect?
I respond to that by saying, Your Honor, that that last section appears in the General Savings Statute, which was enacted for a specific purpose. It is applicable in situations where there has been an unintended repeal of a statute in order to preserve prosecutions in progress at the time.
The state argues that that is not correct, that Section 211 applies where a criminal statute is amended as distinguished from repealed. What is your response?
Well, my response to that is yes, that is what the state is arguing. I think that reliance on that statute, the General Savings Statute, to prohibit and preclude application of the remedial sentences in this case is misplaced and in error. We are not dealing here with a repeal, an unintended abatement. We are not dealing with an unintended repeal of any law. We are not dealing with any ex post facto issues in this case, inasmuch as we're dealing with remedial sentencing provisions.
Are we dealing with an amendment?
Excuse me?
Are we dealing with an amendment to a criminal statute?
Yes, we are. We are dealing, however, with an amendment which does not result in an unintended abatement or repeal. In fact, criminalization of the conduct involved in those statutes continued. In fact, in 16 Delaware Code 4751, possession with intent to deliver was totally unchanged as regards the definition of the criminal conduct therein. We are dealing with sentencing amendments which reduce these sentences if one is convicted of those crimes. We argue that the saving statute in this case, the general saving statute, is not applicable because there is no intended repeal of any law. If there is a repeal of a law or a section of the law, it is the subsection in 4763, which imposed a 15-year minimum mandatory sentence within a range of 30 to 99 years. And clearly that, we argue, is an intended abolishment of that section in recognition of the other purposes that are stated in the enacting amendments of June 30th. Criminalization of the conduct continued was not intended to be repealed. There is no unintended repeal of that criminal conduct in our statutes. And mandatory sentencing did continue for those crimes. So mandatory sentences are still present in the law before and after the amendment. Criminalization of the conduct continues before and after the amendment. These saving statutes, of which 11 Delaware Code 211 is an example, is our law, arose historically from the interplay between new enactments, which cannot retroactively apply because they redefined criminal conduct or they made punishment more onerous, and which it was viewed extinguished the former legal basis of pending prosecutions. In those cases, a general or a specific, or even one implied by the court's savings clause, would operate to save pending prosecutions under the former statute or under the former law, so that the legislative intent to continue to punish the criminal conduct could be carried out. Thus, there is no inadvertent repeal in the case, in the instant case, and there is no challenge that prosecution for criminal activity clearly intended to continue to be criminal would be abated. We believe that the purpose of the general savings statute is made clear, and I've cited that synopsis in my brief. It is clearly the purpose of that statute to avoid an unintended repeal which abates pending prosecutions, and that simply is not the case in Ismail versus State. If the General Assembly's intent as to abatement were otherwise, our general savings statute calls for express language in the amending act to overcome the presumption of continued prosecution. It does not call for express language to permit already permitted action, such as applying remedial sentencing changes in a rational manner for permitted purposes.
So you're arguing that if the amending statute explicitly repealed some prior criminal statute explicitly repealed, then Section 211 would or would not apply?
Would not apply.
And if it unintentionally repealed, that is, didn't use the words repeal, then what? Does Section 211 apply or not?
Then Section 211 would apply. Section 211, the very title of that section in our code is starts out with the word repeal. So the focus of that particular statute is focused on situations of unintended repeal. Repeals caused by a major overhaul or revision of recodifications in a code, or amendments which constitute a repeal. Amendments so extensive as to overhaul a law.
Well, in one sense, any amendment of a statute constitutes a repeal to the extent there's a difference, doesn't it?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct.
So how does one distinguish between amendments that come under, that is, that are covered by Section 211 and those that aren't?
Well, I think it depends on the issue that's before the court, frankly. In this case, we are talking about remedial sentencing provisions. We are not arguing that Mr. Ismail's prosecution ended when that amendment took place. We are not, there is no issue of ex post facto present when one is focusing on a remedial statute, because it simply does not increase the quantum of punishment in a criminal statute. We're not even talking about an amendment in the definition of the criminal conduct under consideration. We're simply talking about provisions which are remedial or mitigating provisions as regards sentencing. Clearly, it's not a case that we think was envisioned by Section 211. Certainly, one could look at it very expansively. We don't think that's the intent, but an expansive view of it would be to say that any amendment of the criminal code is covered by 211. We don't think that that's appropriate. We don't think that that's correct in this case.
All right. One more question. Tell me again which amendments, what category of amendments are covered by Section 211?
Categories of amendments which we believe are covered by subsection B, which does refer to amendments, relate to amendments of a particular statute to such an extent that those amendments could be considered a repeal. In other words, amendments, a reenactment of a section of the code, such as a recodification of Title 11 as took place in 1973.
You would agree, would you not, that subsection B of Section 211 doesn't say that explicitly?
It doesn't say that. It doesn't say that explicitly.
And is there any case, any Delaware authority that you can cite to us that says that?
Well, it's a relatively new statute, 1998. And frankly, I believe that this is the first case in which the intent behind that statute has been examined.
It was surprising to me in reading your brief that you didn't discuss the United States Supreme Court case in Mario at all, because you're asking us to reverse the Superior Court, and the Superior Court relied on what the United States Supreme Court had said in Mario. Why isn't that some relevant consideration for us?
Are we talking about Marrero, the M-E-R-R?
No.
Yeah,
Marrero,
that one?
Yes.
I believe that that extended the principle of that sentencing was considered an integral part or annexed to the crime.
Well, my question is, that's the reason the Superior Court gave for ruling against you.
It is one of the reasons. It is one of the reasons. Those Supreme Court cases, Marrero and the, I believe the Robinson case is not a Supreme Court case, but it's in the line of cases cited by the judge in that by our distinguished trial court judge in that section, I believe, arose from cases in federal courts below applying there. The federal general savings statute to federal legislation. And most of the cases involved federal legislation that contained a specific savings clause, despite the fact that there is a federal general savings clause. As I pointed out in my brief, when it comes to interpreting a general savings clause or issues involving savings, I'm told I should sum up now.
Well, my only point is that one of the difficulties I had in sorting out the case is the cases that the trial judge relied on that you did not cite that were addressed in the state's answering brief, and then you didn't file a reply brief. So as a result, the courts is figuring this out on its own, without the help of your discussion, either in your opening brief of why the judge got it wrong, or in your reply brief that you never filed about why the state's argument is incorrect.
Well, the the court below's decision relied on those cases in interpreting the general savings statute. Our argument is that general savings statute does not apply in this context on these issues. Rather, the focus should be on interpreting the General Assembly's intent in the new enactment of June 30th. That should be the proper focus of determining, you know, if it's ambiguous, that, those amendments, then it's fair to look, to discern the General Assembly's intent in enacting that, rather than jump to the general savings statute, which we think has no application in this case, because we're not dealing with a repeal, and we're not dealing with ex post facto issues.
I take it you'd like to save your remaining time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your
Honor. Good
morning. May it please the Court, my name is Kim Avazian, and I'm representing the state in this matter.
Let me ask you a question before we start so I can put your argument in perspective. Let's assume everything was exactly the same in this case, except we're talking about the death penalty. Is it the state's argument that a person who committed the crime, notwithstanding a subsequent elimination of the death penalty as it was done in this case, would still be executed?
Your Honor, in death penalty cases, as they say, death is always different.
I know, but that's why it helps focus, you know, the state's position when we take it to its logical extreme. Is that the state's position, that a person who committed a crime when the death penalty was in effect would be executed even though the legislature decided to abolish the death penalty?
If this were abolished or overturned because of a constitutional prohibition against the death penalty, the state's position would be no, because the law at that point
No, I'm not talking about the Constitution. We provide for the death penalty by statute. Every state can decide if it wants to have the death penalty or not. My hypothetical is, let's assume the legislature just decided to enact a statute that by statute voluntarily eliminated the death penalty, and they did it in exactly the same way the penalty in this case was changed. So we didn't have any idea whether it was prospective, retroactive. We have to apply all the same principles. Just to focus our inquiry here, my question to you is, it appears the state's position would be the individual would still be subject to the death penalty.
I understand, Your Honor. At this point, the state's argument would be, if the legislature in enacting that new or amending statute did not explicitly provide that it would be retroactive, then yes, the person who had committed the offense before the new statute was amended or repealing the old punishment, that would be the case. I think the fundamental difference between the appellant's position and our position is summed up in a very simple discussion that the state believes that Section 211, the General Savings Clause, is a substantive provision of every new legislation that either repeals or amends criminal laws that relate to crimes in Delaware. And that therefore, the fact that the appellant contends that because it's not explicit, because it might possibly be an ambiguous statute, House Bill 210 as amended, which was enacted on June 30th, that somehow we are supposed to discern the intent of the legislature there as to whether it should be retroactively applied. But the state disagrees completely. That section, that savings clause, is in effect part of House Bill 210, because the legislature is presumed to know what is the law.
Well, as I understand Ms. Dunn's argument, she's saying there's a distinction between the substantive existence of a crime and the sentence, and that the purpose of the savings clause is to make sure that we don't inadvertently decriminalize something that should still be a crime by subsequent appeals or amendment. So the operative time for whether or not it was a crime would be the commission of the offense. However, when we get to the other end of the spectrum in the proceeding, when you're sentenced, you should be sentenced based on what the current law is. Why isn't that a logical distinction? That it's a crime based on when the act was committed, but you're sentenced based on what the law is when you're standing to be sentenced.
Well, I think, first of all, the statute itself, the savings clause, general savings statute, pertains to both the crime as well as the punishment, and there's federal case law out there and other case law, such as the Holiday case, that basically define it as one and the same. But more importantly, I think Section 211 is, in a sense, almost the flip side, the obverse of the ex post facto prohibition. And although Ms. Dunn has characterized the appellant's position as we're only dealing with remedial sentencing provisions here, in fact, in the Superior Court, in the proceedings leading to this decision that's being appealed, one of the arguments was that the defendant wanted to be sure that he was sentenced according to the laws in effect on the date of the offense, because the new House Bill 210 also increased the statutory maximum for trafficking. So in one sense, he wants to be sentenced according to the laws in effect on the date of the offense, vis-a-vis the ex post facto prohibition, but he also wants to be sentenced on the laws that were in effect on the day he was sentenced, i.e. the remedial or the lower penalties. Mr. Ismail can't have it both ways. And Section 211 is in there specifically to say we are going to look at the law, in particular as to the sentencing scheme.
Well, the difficulty in your mirror image argument is that the ex post facto clause of the state and federal constitution wouldn't let him get a greater penalty. But Ms. Dunn's argument is there's no constitutional prohibition against giving him a lesser penalty.
That's correct. There is no constitutional prohibition. However, the scheme that the legislature enacted, the scheme that is reflected in Section 211, is one whereby they are not going to retroactively apply the statute, whether the new sentencing scheme, whether it's to his advantage or disadvantage. Granted, if it's to his disadvantage, they're prohibited under the Constitution. But whether it's to his advantage, it's still not going to be applied. And there are very good rational reasons for doing so.
Are we having this debate because Section 211B doesn't use the word sentencing and uses the phrase any action, case, prosecution, trial, or other legal proceeding in progress, irrespective of the stage of such proceeding? If the word sentencing had explicitly been included there, would there be anything to talk about at all?
I think the Superior Court was correct in interpreting Section 211, subsections A and B, in one harmonious fashion.
Yeah, and the answer to my question is?
It would be helpful if the word sentencing was there, yes.
It would be dispositive, wouldn't it?
Correct. But I think the Superior Court, it was correct in looking at this. I mean, Section A is modeled after the federal statute. In reading Judge Stokes' opinion, the fact that appeals and repeals and amendments are viewed more or less as one and the same under federal law, in Delaware, they make it clear.
Well, let's assume for a moment that the General Assembly has decided that sentencing mechanisms need to change for the reasons acknowledged in the synopsis, and the change is necessary contemporaneously with their passage of the new sentencing structure for the reasons that their synopsis indicates. In the absence of the word sentencing in 211, and we assumed they knew that the word sentencing was not there, why should we conclude, and I don't want to hear about the federal law, but why should we conclude that they intended to maintain the same sentencing that preceded their change of the statute to recognize contemporary needs to readjust sentences?
Because I don't think you can find, even from the synopsis of House Bill 210, that the goal of that provision was necessarily to change it, well, change it immediately upon enactment, but not necessarily change it to apply it to those people who have not yet been sentenced.
Well, the impact, if there is one, that's adverse on the prison system
overcrowding, however you want to characterize it, are simply onerous punishment for these classifications of drug cases as the General Assembly saw it effective June 30th as opposed to the April before, it's exactly the same. The same social policy considerations would apply. Why would you not simply conclude the mere fact the person hadn't proceeded to sentencing yet is no reason not to take into consideration the contemporary needs to readjust sentencing patterns?
Well, there's a facial persuasiveness to that. I mean, there are some, I think that's sort of the underpinnings of the claim that's being made by my opponent. I mean, why not give Mr. Ismail this opportunity? Why not immediately start this process of relieving the overcrowding of the prisons? But they're countervailing concerns as well.
And what are they?
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is, to some, Mr. Ismail may appear a rather sympathetic person who should be given this unexpected windfall in the fact that the sentencing provision has been now
Isn't the General Assembly focusing on the community as a whole and not necessarily on any single defendant when they readjust the sentencing scheme to reduce overcrowding in prisons and make the social policy point that we're putting too many people in jail for the wrong reasons? We have to readjust, put the people who are serious offenders in jail for a longer period of time, and those whose crimes committed are less serious in jail for a lesser period of time.
But that doesn't indicate how that goal, admirable goal, is to be accomplished. And that's where 211 comes in.
Well, before we get to 211, though, why isn't it logical, putting aside the statutory construction, to think that the General Assembly would intend for the law to be effective immediately? They've decided to reduce the sentence. They've enacted a bill that's been signed by the governor. Why wouldn't a reasonable legislator think they changed the law effective immediately?
They have changed the law effective immediately, but not as applied to people whose offenses occurred before the effective date.
Yeah, we know they could have done that if they wanted.
Exactly, and they have done it in other circumstances and other provisions that are found in Title 11 and Title 16.
To be more precise, it's not to people whose offenses occurred prior to, but who were the subject of prosecutions prior to. Isn't that correct?
Well, or I think it can be interpreted more broadly, whether their offenses occurred and whether they were subject to. I think you know, whether the prosecution has actually been initiated. I mean, consider the situation of the felon who commits the crime before the enactment date, and
but
then
Section 211B refers to action, case, prosecution, trial, or other legal proceeding in progress.
And I was also referring to Section 211A, which does not have that limitation. I have the
Section 211A doesn't have that limitation, but it also doesn't have the unless clause that's found in subsection D, does it?
Yes, it does. I believe so.
All right.
Unless the repealing act shall so expressly provide. I think in this case, because the policy goal of relieving overcrowded prisons is one that, you know, appeals to the appellant as justification for his request, but against that policy must be considered the goal for ensuring public safety, which is one of the overriding goals of our criminal code. And one way of doing that is through the deterrent influence of an established sentencing scheme.
Well, obviously the sentencing scheme did not do a very good job of deterring the defendant in this case, because the crime was already committed and he was already convicted of it. So what does deterrence have to do with the current situation of prison overcrowding that the legislature was trying to address?
Because defendants are on, I truly believe, the state truly believes that to apply it to individuals whose prosecution is in progress would work a mischief and also uncertainty into the criminal justice system, because you have people who may be similarly situated, i.e., say, co-defendants. If Mr. Ismail had a co-defendant who had pled guilty and had his case resolved before this law was changed. Then to say that Mr. Ismail, who put the state to the expense and time of prosecuting him and was convicted after the change, after the enactment, the amendment, then to receive the benefit of a reduced penalty when his co-defendant received the stiffer penalty, how would that appear? I mean, this would not create the deterrent effect because this would be open to manipulation by people who want to postpone their trials. It would be open to manipulation by people, felons who flee and abscond from jurisdiction and only are brought back several years later saying, well, in this case, I'm entitled to the reduced penalty. This is what the state, I mean, this is why 211 is a mirror image in a way of the ex post facto. We're going to look at our criminal laws and refer them to the date of the offense, whether it be a remedial sentencing amendment or a other change, whether it involves repeal and reenactment of a crime. This creates clarity, simplicity, and certainty in the system.
I think we all agree that if we wanted absolute clarity, it would have been helpful for the General Assembly to put it in this statute, and they could have made it prospective or retroactive. What we're having difficulty with is what's the intent, and that was my question. You're suggesting that in the absence of any specificity as to the operative effect of the statute, we go to 211 and we apply the old statute to everyone who's sentenced who was in a proceeding, so to speak. And my question is, why is that the logical way to look when we could just as easily say the effective date should be immediate and everyone who's sentenced after this date gets the benefit of the change?
Because I think it is a rational and logical scheme, legislative scheme enacted for sentencing, and that this court has always shown great deference to the legislature when it comes to sentencing.
Well, I'm sure you recall in Holiday, Judge Schwelb wrote in his dissent, "It strikes me as patently incongruous to suggest that the same legislators who found mandatory sentences unfair to some defendants nevertheless intended to require trial judges to continue to impose such sentences after the effective date of the act." Why would legislators want to do that?
Because the line has to be drawn at some point. And I think it can be argued, strenuously argued, that drawing the line at the point of offenses committed before the date of the enactment of the amendment or the reduction in the mandatory sentencing provisions, as opposed to drawing it whenever an individual defendant happens to be sentenced or have a final conviction, is as valid as any other system, and that appears to be the way the Delaware system is structured.
It would be too cynical of me to suggest, would it, that they purposely left it ambiguous, so if the court decided to follow the social policy they most recently announced, that we would get the blame and not them?
I would never say that, Your Honor,
it's Tuesday,
cynical
it's my day to be cynical.
I would say that if anything, it was inadvertent, or the legislature thought that this was perfectly clear and not ambiguous. I really think in this case that there is a system, a sentencing scheme, two sentencing schemes that are both valid and rational. The sentencing scheme that was in existence when Mr. Ismail committed his offenses, and the sentencing scheme that came into existence afterwards, but before he was sentenced. The legislature has spoken, and I think since this is not an unconstitutional or an illegal sentence, that this court should affirm the Superior Court's analysis of House Bill 210 as amended as well as Section 211.
Do you know of any other case in the Superior Court or our court where the legislature's taken similar action in the past to make a sentence less harsh where it's ever been subject to judicial review?
I'm thinking of Bender, State v. Bender. I make it less harsh prior to 211.
This is not a frequent occurrence.
Well, there are cases where the court has found unconstitutional as violating the Eighth Amendment, a certain sentence. I've seen cases where the courts have found sentences to be based on impermissible factors and remanded.
Now, what I was looking for is a case where the legislature has made a conscious decision to reduce a penalty that was later subject to a judicial review with regard to the operative date in Delaware.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't think of a case or an example at this moment.
Thank you very much, Ms. Evason.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I can't imagine a defendant coming into any court and requesting review of a sentence applied that has actually reduced his sentence. If such were the case, it most certainly would have been requested by the state to review such action. But responding to certain points that were raised in the state's argument, we believe it is certainly logical and rational to consider the substantive definition of a crime as different from sentencing, even though sentencing is a law annexed to the crime. They're not part and parcel. There is, one can look to tradition in prior legislative enactments in Delaware for indications that the Assembly and our laws support separating out the sentencing phase from the guilt or innocence phase. And I included a mention of subsections in our statutes, in Delaware statutes, from the 1973 enactment of Title 16, or reenactment or recodification of the drug laws, 1973 recodification of Title 11, enactment of the Truth in Sentencing Law in 1990, the reenactment of, or the enactment, codification of our drug laws in 1973 did in fact contain a clause, a section, subsection, that did say, as regards sentencing, if the sentence attached to a crime in the new law mitigates, is a mitigatory sentence as compared with the old law, mitigation applies. The something similar or a distinction was made, a similar distinction, in terms of the recodification of Title 11 in 1973, which is also mentioned in my brief, which singled out that defenses and mitigations are available if they're given under the new law to people not yet sentenced, I believe is how it's been interpreted.
Mentioned 1973. We see similar statutes in 1990. And in later years. But the state says that goes the other way. If the General Assembly knows how to put a date in a statute, in the absence of putting a date in, then the default position is 211. Why isn't that persuasive?
It's not required. 211 comes into play if the sentence were, if the sentencing scheme or the particular sentence would be greater. You know, obviously it cannot be imposed then, prior to, at any time prior to its enactment date, because of ex post facto concerns, and that gets into the repeal issue. So the two of them operate together to trigger the application of a general savings statute. That simply is not the case here. There is, yes, the General Assembly in the past has included in major revisions and major reenactments, recodifications, a specific savings clause. There wasn't a general savings clause in place at the time. And these were major reenactments. We don't view the June 30th enactment in this case as a major reenactment. It is, its purpose is specifically stated, as your honors have pointed out, in the synopsis of the bill. And there is nothing in our law or in constitutional law that prevents our courts from determining, from carrying out the legislative intent of the June 30th enactment to delineate, you know, which defendants it may apply to, so long as there isn't a due process, so long as there is a rational, it's not an arbitrary decision as to which defendant. Certainly in this case, with a defendant not yet tried, not yet even convicted, not yet sentenced, would seem to be, at the very least, you know, reasonable. Other points that I wanted to respond to was that we do think that the point Your Honor raised about the absence of the word sentence in Section 211 may have some application here, or may have may pique our interest, because there is in certainly as we view the tradition in Delaware statutes to single out sentencing. And the state pointed out that
thank
in
you
our
very much for your argument. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's been a privilege.
Please rise.
Court stands adjourned.
Depart and give their attendance to the call of court. The court is now adjourned. God save the state and the court.